American Notes by Rudyard Kipling. From the Introduction. It is hardly fair to Mr. Kipling to call American Notes first impressions, for one reading them will readily see that the impressions are superficial, little thought being put upon the writing. They seem super sarcastic, and would lead one to believe that Mr. Kipling is antagonistic to America in every respect. This, however, is not true. These notes aroused much protest and severe criticism when they appeared in 1891, and are considered so far beneath Mr. Kipling's real work that they have been nearly suppressed and are rarely found in a list of his writings. Their very caustic style is of interest to a student and lover of Kipling, and for this reason the publishers believe them worthy of a good binding. Chapter 5. Chicago. I know thy cunning and thy greed, thy hard high lust and willful deed, and all thy glory loves to tell of specious gifts material. I have struck a city, a real city, and they call it Chicago. The other places do not count. San Francisco was a pleasure resort as well as a city, and Salt Lake was a phenomenon. This place is the first American city I have encountered. It holds rather more than a million of people with bodies, and stands on the same sort of soil as Calcutta. Having seen it, I urgently desire never to see it again. It is inhabited by savages. Its water is the water of the Hooghly, and its air is dirt. Also, it says that it is the boss town of America. I do not believe that it has anything to do with this country. They told me to go to the Palmer House, which is overmuch gilded and mirrored, and there I found a huge hall of tessellated marble crammed with people talking about money and spitting about everywhere. Other barbarians charged in and out of this inferno with letters and telegrams in their hands, and yet others shouted at each other. A man who had drunk quite as much as was good for him told me that this was the finest hotel in the finest city on God Almighty's earth. By the way, when an American wishes to indicate the next country or state, he says, God Almighty's earth. This prevents discussion and flatters his vanity. Then I went out into the streets, which are long and flat and without end, and verily it is not a good thing to live in the East for any length of time. Your ideas grow to clash with those held by every right-thinking man. I looked down interminable vistas flanked with 9, 10, and 15-storied houses, and crowded with men and women, and the show impressed me with a great horror. Except in London, and I have forgotten what London was like, I had never seen so many white people together, and never such a collection of miserables. There was no color in the street and no beauty, only a maze of wire ropes overhead and dirty stone flagging underfoot. A cab driver volunteered to show me the glory of the town for so much an hour, and with him I wandered far. He conceived that all this turmoil and squash was a thing to be reverently admired, and it was good to huddle men together in 15 layers, one atop the other, and to dig holes in the ground for offices. He said that Chicago was a live town, and that all the creatures hurrying by me were engaged in business. That is to say, they were trying to make some money that they might not die through lack of food to put into their bellies. He took me to canals as black as ink, and filled with untold abominations, and bid me watch the stream of traffic across the bridges. He then took me into a saloon, and while I drank, made me note that the floor was covered with coins sunk in cement. A Hottentot would not have been guilty of this sort of barbarism. The coins made an effect pretty enough, but the man who put them there had no thought of beauty, and therefore he was a savage. Then my cab driver showed me business blocks gay with signs and studded with fantastic and absurd advertisements of goods, and looking down the long street so adorned, it was as though each vendor stood at his door howling. For the sake of my money, employ or buy of me, and me only. Have you ever seen a crowd at a famine relief distribution? You know then how the men leap into the air, stretching out their arms above the crowd in the hope of being seen, while the women dolorously slap the stomachs of their children and whimper. I had sooner watch famine relief than the white man engaged in what he calls legitimate competition. The one I understood, the other makes me ill. And the cabman said that these things were the proof of progress, and by that I knew he had been reading his newspaper, as every intelligent American should. The papers tell their clientele in language fitted to their comprehension that the snarling together of telegraph wires, the heaving up of houses, and the making of money is progress. I spent 10 hours in that huge wilderness, wandering through scores of miles of these terrible streets, and jostling some few hundred thousand of these terrible people who talk paisabat through their noses. The cabman left me, but after a while I picked up another man who was full of figures, and into my ears he poured them as occasion required or the big blank factories suggested. Here they turned out so many $100,000 worth of such and such an article, and there are so many million other things. This house was worth so many $1,000,000, that one so many million, more or less. It was like listening to a child babbling of his hoard of shells. It was like watching a fool playing with buttons. But I was expected to do more than listen or watch. He demanded that I should admire, and the utmost that I could say was, "Are these things so? Then I am very sorry for you." That made him angry, and he said that insular envy made me unresponsive. So you see, I could not make him understand. About 4.5 hours after Adam was turned out of the Garden of Eden, he felt hungry, and so, bidding Eve take care that her head was not broken by the descending fruit, shinned up a coconut palm. That hurt his legs, cut his breast, and made him breathe heavily. And Eve was tormented with fear lest her Lord should miss his footing, and so bring the tragedy of this world to an end ere the curtain had fairly risen. Had I met Adam then, I should have been sorry for him. Today I find 1,100,000 of his sons just as far advanced as their father in the art of getting food, and immeasurably inferior to him in that they think that their palm trees lead straight to the skies. Consequently, I am sorry rather more than 1,000,000 different ways. In the East, bread comes naturally, even to the poorest, by a little scratching or the gift of a friend not quite so poor. In less favored countries, one is apt to forget. Then I went to bed, and that was on a Saturday night. Sunday brought me the queerest experience of all, a revelation of barbarism complete. I found a place that was officially described as a church. It was a circus, really, but that the worshippers did not know. There were flowers all about the building, which was fitted up with plush and stained oak and much luxury, including twisted brass candlesticks of severest Gothic design. To these things and a congregation of savages entered suddenly a wonderful man, completely in the confidence of their God, whom he treated colloquially and exploited very much as a newspaper would exploit a foreign potentate. But unlike the newspaper reporter, he never allowed his listeners to forget that he, and not he, was the center of attraction. With a voice of silver and with imagery borrowed from the auction room, he built up for his hearers a heaven on the lines of the Palmer House, but with all the gilding real gold and all the plate glass diamond, and set in the center of it a loud-voiced, argumentative, very shrewd creation that he called God. One sentence at this point caught my delighted ear. It was apropos of some question of the judgment and ran, "No, I tell you, God doesn't do business that way." He was giving them a deity whom they could comprehend and a gold and jeweled heaven in which they could take a natural interest. He interlarded his performance with the slang of the streets, the counter, and the exchange, and he said that religion ought to enter into daily life. Consequently, I presume he introduced it as daily life, his own and the life of his friends. Then I escaped before the blessing, desiring no benediction at such hands. But the persons who listened seemed to enjoy themselves, and I understood that I had met with a popular preacher. Later on, when I had perused the sermons of a gentleman called Talmage and some others, I perceived that I had been listening to a very mild specimen. Yet that man, in his brutal gold and silver idols, his hands in pocket, cigar in mouth, and hat on the back of the head style of dealing with the sacred vessels, would count himself spiritually quite competent to send a mission to convert the Indians. All that Sunday I listened to people who said that the mere fact of spiking down strips of iron to wood and getting a steam and iron thing to run along them was progress, that the telephone was progress, and the network of wires overhead was progress. They repeated their statements again and again. One of them took me to their city hall and board of trade works and pointed it out with pride. It was very ugly, but very big, and the streets in front of it were narrow and unclean. When I saw the faces of the men who did business in that building, I felt that there had been a mistake in their billeting. By the way, 'tis a consolation to feel that I am not writing to an English audience. Then I should have to fall into feigned ecstasies over the marvelous progress of Chicago since the days of the Great Fire, to allude casually to the rising of the entire city so many feet above the level of the lake which it faces, and generally to grovel before the golden calf. But you, who are desperately poor, and therefore by these standards of no account, no things, will understand when I write that they have managed to get a million of men together on flat land, and that the bulk of these men together appear to be lower than Mahajans, and not so companionable as a Punjabi jat after harvest. But I don't think it was the blind hurry of the people, their argot, and their grand ignorance of things beyond their immediate interest that displeased me so much, as a study of the daily papers of Chicago. Imprimis. There was some sort of dispute between New York and Chicago as to which town should give an exhibition of products to be hereafter holden, and through the medium of their more dignified journals, the two cities were yahooing and hi-ying at each other like opposition newsboys. They called it humor, but it sounded like something quite different. That was only the first trouble. The second lay in the tone of the productions. Leading articles, which included gems such as "Back of such and such a place," or "We notice Tuesday such an event," or "Don't for does not," are things to be accepted with thankfulness. All that made me want to cry was that in these papers were faithfully reproduced all the war cries and back talk of the Palmer House bar, the slang of the barber shops, the mental elevation and integrity of the Pullman car porter, the dignity of the dime museum, and the accuracy of the excited fishwife. I am sternly forbidden to believe that the paper educates the public. Then I am compelled to believe that the public educate the paper. Yet suicides on the press are rare.